Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, the weekly mix of science interviews with great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, a planet of 7 billion people, the science behind hurricane predictions, electric power in our veins, and sky-watching storms on Saturn. Here's a scientist soundbite.
With the La Nina in the Pacific, it's cooler than normal waters out there. It changes the whole weather patterns around the world. Some places get wetter, some get drier. And one effect that we see fairly regularly with Atlantic hurricanes is enhanced hurricane activity in the Atlantic.
You're listening to Chris Lancey, the Science and Operations Officer at the U.S. National Hurricane Center, which is part of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. NOAA has issued its initial outlook for Atlantic hurricanes in 2011. On the line to talk more about the 2011 hurricane season is Chris Lancey. Dr. Lancey, welcome.
Well, thanks. Glad to help out today.
What's important for people to know about the 2011 Atlantic hurricane season?
Well, I think the most important fact is that what this implies for any individual state or city or county or any individual, it really doesn't help too much. A hurricane strike at any individual place is a very rare event, whether it's a busy year or a quiet year. So with this outlook, we really can't answer the question, who's going to be hit this year? All we can say is it looks like it's going to be a busier overall. But for any individual place, we really don't know.
This hurricane forecast, it doesn't predict hurricanes that actually make landfall, is that right?
Yeah, what we can do is get a good sense of the overall activity. So, for example, the forecast that we just came out with is 6 to 10 hurricanes, and an average hurricane season is about 6 hurricanes. What we don't know, though, is where they form, what we call the genesis locations, or the steering that'll show up once there's a hurricane out there. And that's why the seasonal outlook, while it's of interest, it kind of has limited utility at the state or local level.
How should people use NOAA's hurricane forecast?
Well, for any individual homeowners, families, small business owners, we would not want them to make any change to their preparations for this hurricane season based on the outlook we just issued. Because, for example, last year it was very busy overall, but we had no U.S. landfalling hurricanes. And conversely, you can have a relatively quiet season, like in 1992. It was predicted to be a very quiet year overall. There was only 4 hurricanes. But if you lived in Miami-Dade County, it was the worst hurricane you ever experienced when Andrew came roaring ashore. So we really don't want most people to really change anything for their preparations. What we want people to be aware of is that hurricane season's coming. It'll be here 1st of June. And to really have a plan for what to do when a hurricane threatens your community.
Looking at the science of hurricanes, what weather and climate elements are making the biggest influence on hurricanes in 2011?
Right. The two main factors that we're looking at for the seasonal hurricane forecast for the Atlantic this year, the first of which is that we've been in a La Nina event. And La Nina is cooler than normal waters in the eastern Pacific. That actually has a remote effect where cooler waters there promote more hurricanes in the Atlantic, because it tends to reduce the amount of wind shear that tears apart the storms and allows more thunderstorms to develop. We had been in a La Nina, and that was one of the reasons 2010 was so busy. And it does appear that there'll be some lingering effects from the La Nina as it appears to start fading away. The second factor is we've been in enhanced activity since 1995. Both because of the reduced vertical wind shear as well as warmer waters, and that appears to still be in place for 2011 as well. There is a lot of uncertainty on this outlook, and there always is in the kind of when we issue these in May, and that's partly because the La Nina could switch to an El Nino by the peak of the hurricane season. We don't anticipate it that it will, but it's certainly not outside the realms of possibility.
Dr. Lancey, how are these hurricane forecasts generated?
First thing we do when we're putting together the seasonal outlook is examine all the environmental factors that we know affect hurricanes. We're looking at the wind shear, that's the changing winds with height throughout the atmosphere. We're looking at the ocean temperatures, and we're looking at this big phenomenon called El Niño and La Niña, and seeing if it's going to be switching at all. And so we're putting a lot of that information into statistical techniques, whether it's an analog technique where we're looking at past years that look most similar to 2011, or a little more sophisticated regression models. In the last couple of years, we've also been getting output from various climate models themselves, where various groups integrate forward in time for the next several months what the weather patterns may be. And these are looking to be more skillful, and they're suggesting this year that we will not have an El Niño, and that we'll have an active hurricane season. So, for example, we're getting these model output from the climate forecast system from the U.S. National Weather Service. We're getting the climate model output from the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecasting. And we're also getting the U.K. Met Office's seasonal output. So we're putting a little more emphasis in the last couple of years on these little more sophisticated full physics computer models nowadays.
That was Chris Lancy, the Science and Operations Officer at the U.S. National Hurricane Center. Weird Science with Ryan Britton is up next, but first, here's a song called Seabird by the Austin band Monahans, featuring Sinead O'Connor.
Someday we might get it right.
Earth Sky heard on 1,200 stations around the world, including Voice of America. It's Weird Science Time this week with Ryan Britton. Ryan, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
So tell us about this story on generating electricity inside a person's body.
Right. So it's fairly well known that we human beings have a bit of electricity running through us. Our bodies, they generate enough electricity to light up a light bulb or two. But today, I have a weird medical science story about teeny tiny little turbines that can be inserted into the bloodstream or the blood vessels of a human to generate electricity. These small turbines would basically spin off of blood pressure and generate electricity.
Yeah, waste not, want not. So, I mean, how useful is this, this electricity that we produce in our bodies? Can we use it to power iPods and smartphones?
Wouldn't that be cool? But no, the idea here is to power medical devices such as pacemakers. A group of scientists at Bern University of Applied Sciences in Switzerland, they managed 800 microwatts of power from one turbine planted in a human blood vessel.
Oh, it's kind of like a mini hydroelectric generator.
Exactly, yeah. But there's a big catch at this stage. The major drawback is that eddies and turbulence within the bloodstream, they tend to coagulate the blood. The stirring causes blood clots that can cause strokes, heart attacks, and other tissue death. So it's sort of a big barrier to overcome. But what these scientists have proved is that the concept works. Our blood pressure can generate electricity using little turbines.
But yeah, like you say, the disclaimer is that it can cause strokes, heart attacks, and other tissue death.
Yes, kind of serious at this point, but there could be a solution down the road. You know, science will find it if it exists.
I mean, so how would this work? Would there be a plug on the side of us?
Well, you know, I'm not sure yet, but it seems like, you know, the fact that these turbines can work, it's one more step in the melding of man and machine. So we could have plugs. You know, humans could be a lot more biomechanical in the future.
So where can people find out more about these tiny inner turbines?
These blood vessel turbines? Yeah, there are articles at popsci.com and gizmodo.com.
Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
Earth Sky is Ryan Britton, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Love to hear from you on Facebook. Tell us where you're from. You can find us as Earth Sky. Deborah Bird is here now with news on the global night sky and a weather report from Saturn. Welcome, Deborah.
Hello, Jorge. There has been a storm going on Saturn since late 2010. So many months now, this storm has been raging on Saturn. And you know, Saturn is the second biggest planet in our solar system. It's more than 9 times the diameter of Earth. And this storm at times has wrapped around the entire northern hemisphere of that planet.
It's a big storm.
It's a very big storm.
So yeah, tell us what do scientists know about it? What's happening, and why are there storms on Saturn?
Well, first let me say that this storm was actually noticed by amateur astronomers in December of 2010, as Earth and Saturn are going around the sun, where we see Saturn in our night sky changes. And in December of 2010, Saturn was just reemerging into the pre-dawn sky, into the eastern pre-dawn sky, and amateur astronomers turned their telescopes on it and noticed that something strange was happening in the normally quiet disk of Saturn. Jupiter, of course, has its great red spot, which is thought to be a giant hurricane as large as 3 planet Earths. But Saturn's atmosphere is generally much more quiet. So when this storm appeared, it was very noticeable.
Yeah, so this looks like a band that goes all the way around on the northern part of Saturn?
Well, it's changed over the past months. In January, there were some wonderful pictures of it. And in fact, if you'll come to our website at earthsky.org and search for the words Saturn storm, we've got a collection of images of the storm. In January, it looked kind of like Jupiter's red spot. It extended quite a ways across the planet. Looks like just a patch on the planet that's changing shape all the time as this storm on Saturn has been raging over the past several months.
Yeah, it's weird to think about these large storms weather happening on other planets.
It is, Jorge. And, you know, it's weird to stand on Earth and see Saturn in the night sky, which, of course, now is the best time of 2011 to be seeing Saturn. It's coming up, or it's already up in the eastern sky now, close to a bright star, the star Spica in the constellation Virgo. So if you're standing, it's strange to be standing on Earth and looking at Saturn and realizing, wow, that's another planet, and it has weather and it has storms, just like Earth has storms.
Yeah.
But much, much, much more powerful. And I think that's to me, you know, as somebody who's been studying the planets for 40 years, you know, it's kind of a lesson to realize there's storms on other planets that can wrap around the whole planet.
Deborah, do you have any tips for sky watchers on finding Saturn in the night sky?
Well, Saturn is a golden planet. It's the faintest of the bright planets, so it's not a particularly bright planet. It's not as bright as Venus or Jupiter. It is near the bright star Spica, which is a blue-white star. So if you happen to notice two stars close together, one golden in color, one blue-white, that'll be Saturn and Spica. They're in the east when the sun goes down, as seen from all over the globe. One surefire way to find them is to wait until around June 9th or 10th, and on those dates, Saturn and Spica will be near the moon.
And anyone on Earth, anywhere, should be able to see these with clear skies.
Absolutely.
And for scientists who are looking at Saturn right now as it's going through these storms, what are they finding out about the storms on Saturn?
Well, these storms on Saturn are very rare. They've been observed only 6 times since the year 1876. And what's cool about this time is that we have a spacecraft in orbit around Saturn, the Cassini spacecraft. So scientists are looking at this storm. One of the things that they've discovered is that there are ammonia crystals from deeper down in Saturn that have been pushed up into Saturn's upper atmosphere by this storm.
And scientists know that by looking at the ammonia that is in the storms that they're finding on Saturn right now.
That's right. So the ammonia is usually deeper down, but now because of the storm, it's been pushed up into the upper atmosphere where scientists can observe it and confirm that it exists on Saturn.
That's awesome. I think it's amazing also that it took amateur astronomers to find this.
Yes, it is. And of course, amateur astronomers are the ones who are keeping an eye on the skies.
Well, thanks for the weather update from Saturn, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We're Earth Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. Beth Lebwohl joins us now with a story on human population expected to reach 7 billion by 2011. Welcome, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Jorge.
So tell us about your interview with population expert Hania Zlotnik.
Well, Dr. Zlotnik is a UN Population Division Director. That is United Nations Population Division Director. And we talked about how Earth's human population is expected to hit 7 billion this year on October 31st, which is coincidentally Halloween for those of us in the United States. But we also talked about future population projections. So in 2050, Earth's population is expected to hit 9.3 billion. And in the year 2100, Earth's population is expected to hit a whopping 10.1 billion. Although, as Dr. Zlotnik expressed to me, that number is quite uncertain, and she explained why.
What we have tried to emphasize is, in fact, that yes, going to 2050 has less uncertainty because by today, everyone who's going to be 40 and over in 2050 has already been born. So we have some information on those people. So we're just projecting the rest of the population and, of course, the deaths of the people that are now alive. But when one goes 90 years into the future, most people are not yet there, so the uncertainty grows.
So Dr. Zlotnik explained to me, and I was actually surprised to hear this, that the UN is so uncertain that she said that no number is more certain than another. In other words, the UN provided a range. The world population could be as low as 6 billion and as high as 16 billion in the year 2100. And she said, well, actually, this mid-range number, 10.1, it's not necessarily more certain than the others, which I found to be interesting.
And one thing I think is interesting also is that population isn't exploding everywhere. There are some places on Earth where the population growth is a lot higher than others, right?
That's exactly right, Jorge. And Dr. Zlotnik talked a little bit about that as well. Take it away, Dr. Zlotnik.
42% of the population is living in countries that are not producing enough children to replace their generations. That means their population will start declining sometime in the future if they maintain this low fertility.
Okay, so Dr. Zlotnik talks about replacement level fertility, and I just wanted to explain that briefly. When a couple has 2 children, they're replacing themselves, right? That's replacement level fertility. But when a couple has only one child, that's below replacement level. So that's a good way of thinking about it. So countries in the world that have below replacement level fertility, these are places like Europe and China. Places around replacement level fertility, but it's a little bit higher than Europe and China. These are places like the United States, Brazil, India. And the places with the highest population growth on the planet are actually in developing countries that are spread geographically. So these include Haiti, Bolivia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and many countries in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah, and Beth, the UN is also looking at the role of women in influencing global population.
Yes. The United Nations is concerned, among other things, about how they're going to feed 10 billion people. And so they are trying to figure out ways to effectively cap or very much slow global population. And so Dr. Zlotnick believes that family planning is an important key, but also the empowerment and education of women.
The important thing to emphasize again is that fertility has been reduced in almost every country of the world. So the ones where fertility has declined quite a bit have had a combination of policies that have helped reduce fertility. And the one that is essential is to provide the means by which people can plan their families, and that is done usually through family planning programs. Family planning plays a role. Communication and empowerment of women plays another role. And it's also very important that the mortality of children declines, because if families are having children and seeing them die, they are likely to want to have more children to make sure that some of them survive to adulthood. So declining child mortality is very important, but that is already happening in many countries.
That was Hanya Zlotnick, the Population Division Director for the United Nations. Thank you, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl. That's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, The Black and White Ears, 100 Flowers, Monahans, Black Books, and Daniel Webb. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science. And to take you out now, a song by Black Books, off their debut EP, An Introduction to...